www.thebeatles.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. High-speed internet access is becoming increasingly important, but access is often challenging due to ready availability and the cost of that access. Closing the gap is not only important as an educational tool, but as an economic development tool. We've heard for years that information. Well, now comes another reason to close the gap: civic engagement. Technology can feed an urban revival in the municipal arena. It can make a city more responsive to its citizens, even as citizens can use that technology to learn more about the cities in which they live and how they work. Susan Crawford is a professor at Harvard Law School and co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. She is also the co-author of The Responsive City, Engaging Communities Through Data Smart Governance, and she joins us for the hour from studios in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning, Susan. Welcome.
Good morning.
And with us in our studio is Bruce Clark. He happens to be, and you probably didn't know there was such a thing, but he happens to be Charlotte's first digital inclusion project manager. He is not a city employee. His position is funded through a grant at the Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte, and he holds up at the main branch of the Charlotte Library. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, we'll talk more about that. Welcome. And from the James L. Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte is the dean of that school, Dr. Eric Friedman, who is also a member of the editorial board for Digital Charlotte. Good morning and welcome back. You've been here before. I know you have.
I have. It's great to be here again.
Nice to have you here. Susan, your book, The Responsive City, is about improving governance, particularly local urban governments, through technology. And you say that those local governments today are at a critical juncture when it comes to this. How so?
Well, this is really the most interesting time in the last 100 years to be involved in local government, because using digital technology, government agencies can much better understand what they're up to. They can trade information in a way they haven't been able to in the past. Information's been locked up within individual city departments. They can visualize the progress of the city. They can communicate with people who live in cities much more effectively, creating really a thick civic mesh of engagement and visibility and liveliness and attraction across all the cities that are working in this direction. I'm seeing a sweeping movement around the world involved in using digital technology, particularly data and screens, to drive ahead, bolster, make more effective the job of governance.
We've talked a lot over the years about data. We're just now beginning to talk about screens. When you say screens, mm-hmm. what do you mean?
Well, I actually think these little screens we're holding in our hands mm-hmm. are pretty primitive. I think we'll get away from that at some point. Really, we'll have an electronic layer of life that we'll be seeing at the same time we're seeing real life. It'll just be a thicker tapestry of engagement. I know that sounds hopelessly vague. What I'm aiming towards is when we make things visible, we make progress. And the ability to use digital information to project on surfaces, to allow surfaces to engage with us, is extraordinary. And we're just at the beginning of that.
You're nodding vigorously about all of this, Bruce. Do you know what she's talking about? I have no clue what she's talking about.
I'm dreaming about what she's talking about.
Is this like the HoloLens or Google Glass or something we'd see in Back to the Future? I mean, is that what we're talking about here?
I'm not exactly sure, but okay. I see some projections on buildings. Okay. I see ways of interacting with information. Definitely is beyond what we're used
What's
to.
What's that currently. Tom Cruise movie that he saw? I forget. It sounds like that.
The Matrix. The Matrix. You're on it. That's the idea.
That's the idea. You say cities like businesses are being called on to do more with less, which is true everywhere around the country, and this is where technology mm-hmm. can actually help. But it's been my experience interfacing with local government that, and not just here but elsewhere, that they usually have, and this is true of the United States government, I think, the oldest, slowest, most outdated computer systems on the planet because nobody wants to pay the money to upgrade them. 10-year-olds with iPads have more power in their hands than some of these government agencies. So is that the first step to get with the times? Find the money to update these systems so that you can do more with less.
First, you have to show that updating the systems is going to provide value to citizens. So I tell a story in the book about Bill Oates, this former CIO, Chief Information Officer of Boston, who walked into Boston City Hall from Starwood Hotels, where he'd been the Chief Information Officer, and heard typewriters. And he said to the mayor, Mayor Menino at the time, in 2006, he said, Mayor, we have to do something about these facilities so that we can start serving citizens better. And the mayor was not a tech guy, but he understood that using data and screens and interfaces to allow citizens to engage with City Hall would do what he wanted, which was to meet more of the people of Boston and make them feel as if their city was working for them. So Bill was able to prove the case for better infrastructure to the mayor. They did a massive updating. And funny thing, this last summer, 60% of Boston's residents change places on September 1. Everybody moves out, moves in. It's a big student moment of lease changeover. And that process had always been done for moving vans by standing in line in two different departments in City Hall. And Boston managed to move all of that online so you can get your moving van permit without spending hours in line. That sounds like a small thing, but it's huge for people wanting to feel that Boston is a better place to live, a place that is with it when it comes to digital technology.
So you're talking about Boston. You also work with the city of New York, which we'll talk about a little while from now. But you also say that Chicago, the city of Chicago, is on the right track, that they're doing things pretty well in terms of using data to solve problems and to democratize data for the people who live there. What are they doing?
Well, what's fascinating about Chicago is that they've thought through having many different kinds of roles in the city that work together. There are people who, like Bruce, are very focused on digital inclusion, are not city employees, but work as a kind of layer between City Hall and neighborhoods to help people up the ladder of digital literacy, to help them understand why internet access is relevant to their lives and helpful to them. There's also a wonderful crowd of people in City Hall who are very digitally competent, are using data to target and prioritize the activities of the city. And then they've got a big community of civic hackers building applications that use the open data that Chicago releases from its own coffers. So it's a whole recipe for making the city work more effectively, using fewer resources, but also at the same time bolstering the case, showing the city's work, showing how relevant local government is to people's lives so that they don't take it for granted and they support it the next time local government needs to do something big.
Susan Crawford is coming to town, by the way. She'll be here Thursday night at Queen's University of Charlotte at Kettner Auditorium to talk about exactly what we're talking about here in more detail. Dr. Eric Friedman is the dean of the James L. Knight School of Communications, and it's your school that has sponsored the Bruce Clark's job, the project director for the Charlotte Digital Inclusion. Why did you feel this was necessary to have a position like this and to make this happen in Charlotte?
Sure. And I think as Susan pointed out, it's really important for us to establish an intermediary that's not beholden to the city of Charlotte, that's not beholden to people that might be solving some of the infrastructure problems like our private companies, carriers who are building high-speed internet access. So earlier this year, in early 2015, we began convening a broad array of community stakeholders as a series of checks and balances to build a strategic plan, to build those reciprocal relationships, to develop some intentional outreach with especially some of our lower-income and vulnerable populations who might be left behind. So we looked across Charlotte to say, who might help us develop that strategic plan, bridge the digital divide, move towards digital inclusion? And we started to build a steering team, and we hired Bruce to really lead that effort. And that steering team includes representatives from the city, representatives from the county, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Libraries, our school, the Knight Foundation, the Urban League of Central Carolina's Goodwill, Media Democracy Fund, Charlotte Heart Gigabits, anyone who might have some ideas, who might be invested in certain sub-communities or micro-communities in Charlotte, who could bring something to the table to help us really move forward with why is access important? How do we make it relevant to a really broad and diverse constituency.
And Bruce, you're a young guy. Your background, as I understand it, was as executive director of the PPL, the People, which was an independent media hub formed during the 2012 Democratic National Convention, which was held here in Charlotte. This seems like an impossible job to me because you're not an official. You are not being paid by taxpayers. You have no power or authority. You can only guide, suggest, and nudge. So how do you open people's eyes to the need for digital inclusion, both on both sides of the equation, both the people who will supply it or make it available, and to those who will use it ultimately if it becomes available, who may not even understand why they need it?
Well, I mean, I think our future economy is driving adoption in a number of areas. That's helping at the top side of that in the business community and sort of those who have the resources to take advantage of it. And the challenge is, how does that come down to a community that doesn't have those same resources? And I think my role is to create an ecosystem in Charlotte so that both sides of those equation can find the benefit in each other and why it matters to each side. So, for example, I think it's critically important for our workforce development. You know, how are we training and creating opportunities for our future economy and employing the people in our city? And part of those is giving them the skills and the ability to take advantage of technology and the way that we communicate and the way that we interact.
We've talked about the city of Salisbury with regard to this on this program in the past. We got an email last night in advance of this show from somebody up there. Salisbury just announced last month it is upgrading to a 10 gigabit internet speed through its municipally owned fiber optic network called Vibrant. Salisbury's Vibrant is one of 18 systems, municipal systems, that is citywide, with no digital divide. You're obviously aware of this, Doctor, mm-hmm. because you're nodding your head. This began in 2010 to encourage economic development and provide Salisbury residents with globally competitive access to the world at their fingertips. So do you see more cities doing this, more smaller cities like Salisbury doing this, and are they ahead of Charlotte?
I think some of them are ahead of Charlotte. And I think a lot of that really depends on city and state regulation, and we have a much more sort of restrictive or prescriptive environment here in North Carolina that has perhaps impeded the development of community networks.
What does that mean? Who's restricting it, the legislature or the city council or the county commission? Who's restricting it and why?
I'm not 100% sure, so I don't want to act as the subject matter expert, but we do know in Wilson, North Carolina, that they have gone ahead with a broadband municipal network and won a court case against the state earlier this year that I believe is still being challenged. And outside of North Carolina, and Susan may be better to talk about this, but outside of North Carolina, when we talk to folks outside, they say that North Carolina is ground zero for this conversation between sort of potentially old, archaic laws that restrictions that would have prevented things like public Wi-Fi networks. And what we're seeing now is places like Wilson and other cities who are challenging that because they see the significance and what it means to their community.
So are these laws, these restrictions, are they in place to protect the traditional commercial providers of internet access? Like your Time Warner cables, like your AT&Ts, like the other cable systems that are scattered around the state? I don't want to put you in a politically bad position here.
I'll do it.
Okay, go ahead, Susan. You do it. You have no horse in the race.
I'm the out-of-stater. So Bruce is exactly right. There's a 2011 state law, heavily backed by Time Warner Cable, that makes it difficult or impossible for municipalities in North Carolina to extend their fiber networks beyond their boundaries. And that's a drag on economic development.
And let me stop you there. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this conversation in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Initiative and Talk It Out NC, a program that helps parents address underage drinking and initiate age-appropriate conversations with children from 8 to 18. TalkItOutNC.org. And WTVI presenting Carolina Impact, highlighting North Carolina's first venture into kindergarten through 12th online classrooms, along with Christopher Green from the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra, tonight at 8, WTVI, PBS, Charlotte. The February 2014 spill of coal ash from a pond at Duke Energy's Dan River plant in Eden brought attention to a festering problem, the tons of coal ash being stored all over the state. That spill opened eyes about how vulnerable these storage ponds can be. Duke is involved in a cleanup, fines have been levied, laws changed, and the public has learned more about this substance and how it could affect them. We will get an update on what's been going on around coal ash tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, last week state regulators in Nevada ruled that daily fantasy sports games need to be licensed, how the multi-billion dollar industry operates, and why the Justice Department and the FBI have opened investigations.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about bridging the digital divide. Susan Crawford is with us. She's from Harvard University, the law school there. She's also the co-author of The Responsive City, Engaging Communities Through Data Smart Governance. And she'll be in town at Queen's University on Thursday at 7 p.m. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. Bruce Clark is here, Charlotte's first digital inclusion project manager, and Dr. Eric Friedman, dean of the James L. Knight School of Communication, sponsoring both Bruce Clark's job and Susan Crawford's appearance here in Charlotte. Let me get back to Chicago for a second, where, Susan, you say they really are making great use of this whole new technology paradigm, and they're using an open data platform so that any researcher can use the incredible amount of information that any city brings in on a daily basis. What do you mean by an open data program and or platform, and how are they putting that on the web, and how do people use it?
Well, there's a fascinating story just happening right now in Chicago. The city and the University of Chicago, working together, are putting up sensors in many places around downtown and neighborhoods that pick up data about environmental conditions. What's the air quality? What's the light quality? How noisy is it as a general matter? How congested is the city? Not taking pictures of individual people, but just counting them as they go by. Using all of that data, the University of Chicago then instantly makes it available on an online open platform and also helps other cities make their city data available on that platform.
And who's using all that? Who's using all? Is it average citizens, or is it traffic planners, or people deciding where to locate businesses? Who's using it?
Well, let's dream about this. Right now, it's researchers looking for ways to track health impacts in cities to see the correlations between particular air quality and maybe businesses that are there. Certainly, traffic planners worried about congestion in the city. It's as if you had a sort of fitness tracker on the city that can be used for a host of reasons, none of which are privacy invasive, all of which can then be compared across other cities. All applications can be built on top of this by private industry. It's really quite exciting.
So app developers could develop an app for your smartphone, which you put on your phone if you live in Chicago, and you could find out all kinds of instant, real-time information about what's happening in your city.
In your city, like what's the least crowded way to walk to work? Where's the ice forming on the sidewalk? How is your weather different from everybody else's? It's very localized. It's really something.
But, of course, the other aspect of this, cities using data, is to increase citizen involvement and make it easier for citizens to know what's going on within their governments and to participate in it without having to go to meetings and spend 3 hours getting there and sitting in a meeting and coming back home only to talk for 20 seconds. You could actually just participate online. How sophisticated would a citizen have to be able to do that? And why would governments, because power, you know, knowledge is power, why would they want to open themselves up to this kind of participation when they don't really have to?
Well, there are two steps here, and Bruce's story is really central to this, too.
Okay.
Chicago has 40% of its citizens without internet access at home, always the poor and more vulnerable population. So they have to fix that as well. The city wants to learn from its people what they care about. You know, cities are for people, not for the people in City Hall, necessarily.
Do the people in City Hall know that?
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
And what they're looking for is, let's take planning, for example. What if you could just with a text message or a response on a touchscreen in your neighborhood indicate where you'd like particular street furniture to go, like street lamps and news kiosks? People really care about things like that in their neighborhood. To get that real-time neighborhood-level information for a city is very valuable.
How far behind being able to do that are we here in Charlotte, Bruce?
Yeah, I don't think we're too far behind. I mean, I think the thought is there in the walls of government. I think that they're thinking about how to do this, how to make themselves more accessible. Our police department, you could text the police department. You can tweet at the police department if you see something, and they'll receive that. I've asked that question directly to them to confirm that you could actually do that. Mm-hmm. In fact, I tried it out one time with animal control, and we got a response. And so, you know, I think that the beginnings of that and the ideas of what it could be are already planted here. It's the watering and the nurturing of those ideas to see them flourish in our community.
So to accomplish what Susan is talking about being accomplished right now in Chicago, you need citizens connected to the internet in some way, probably on a relatively high speed connection because it's a lot of data coming and going. What about Wi-Fi? It sounds like Wi-Fi is important, too, and it would be probably universal public Wi-Fi, wouldn't it? I mean, how is it happening there in Chicago? How are we seeing it happening here in Charlotte?
Well, so the open data piece, for us, it's been a three-pronged approach. So we've had a city and a county that's been very responsive to making their data open, building a quality of life dashboard for all residents to see how their neighborhoods rate and a variety of quality measures.
So for people who don't know the jargon, a dashboard would be what?
It's a very malleable, sort of easy to enter user interface where you can plug in your address and that can bring up a number of indicators that show across Charlotte, across Mecklenburg County, for example, how walkable is my neighborhood? Mm-hmm. And it provides a series of maps that are, again, the user interface, it's not just about data. The data is there for organizations to host hackathons, for organizations like Code for Charlotte to really build more sophisticated apps to make the data even more malleable and user-friendly. But for the everyday citizen or resident, the city has provided a fairly easy-to-read interface with plenty of visuals to really give them a sense of how their neighborhood relates to other entities across Mecklenburg County.
Where is that interface? Where is that dashboard? How do you find that?
Quality of Life Explorer is its official name, and you can simply Google it, and the website will probably be the first one to come up.
Are they keeping that secret deliberately? Because I never heard of it before.
You should follow me on Twitter because I tweet about it a lot.
So they are pushing it out there.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. I mean, obviously, I'm in a circle of people who talk about it a lot, so I hear about it a lot. But as Eric said, there's incredibly rich data there, and there's I think the most exciting thing is what we haven't found out yet about that data. What are the connection points that we don't know yet? Hmm. You know, thinking about challenges that we face in our community. You know, even most recently with these safety zones, like how do we look at those safety zones and overlay a number of other data points to understand what other causes could be we should be thinking about that we're not currently, other than sort of the traditional ones that we've done with our own analysis previously.
And to Bruce's point, so you have a city that's made its data open. You have hackers, sort of data experts who are able to manipulate the data, build the apps and make it more friendly. But the third piece is engaging with residents, and we've been doing this on a workshop model to make them more familiar with things like the Quality of Life Explorer so they know where it is, but also asking them, building the reciprocal piece. So what is missing here? What would you like to see? What data, what evidence, what information is important to you? And the final piece, which you were asking about, is what we can also identify is where are the Wi-Fi or information deserts, and that's a really important piece because without access, they're not connecting to the interface.
This kind of thing is happening, as Susan pointed out, in Chicago. It's happening in Boston. It's happening in Detroit. It's certainly happening in New York City. It's happening in some of the major cities in this country. And we have to remember that although we sometimes don't think of ourselves as that, we are. We're in the top 20 cities in the country here in Charlotte, and we're bigger than Atlanta. So where do we stand in comparison to the top 10 or the top 5 cities? And where do we stand in terms of the lower tier cities? Are we in the middle of the pack?
We are we did a community survey back in October 2012 that assessed home internet access. Mm-hmm. And when we compare that to Pew data, we came out fairly equivalent with the national standard, which is about 17% of homes that do not have internet access. And in Charlotte, it was about 18 or 19% homes without internet access. The real issue for us as a city, is identifying those populations that are disenfranchised, where we see lower internet access, lower home use, lower home access. And in some of our zip codes, we see that number moving up to about 30 to 40% of homes that do not have internet access. So at that level, I think we've identified these pockets, but we have a lot of work to do.
What is this comparable to? Let's go back a century. What is this comparable to? Is this comparable to people not having a telephone, not having internet access? Is it comparable to people not having a telephone or not having a radio in their home or not having a TV in their home at some point in time? Or is it more important than not having those things?
I mean, the story that I say is, imagine a child doing homework in the dark. And we gave them a light bulb, and we created we brought electricity to people's homes, and now they can do their work at any time of the day. This is the same challenge we face today. It's as significant as electricity.
But we didn't, although we did subsidize through the rural electric cooperatives, bringing electricity to people way out in the hinterlands where there wasn't a lot of infrastructure or need for infrastructure. We did subsidize that. But we didn't give away free telephones. We didn't pay people's power bills in the cities. We didn't buy them a television if they didn't have a TV in the house. There are people out there probably thinking, why are we so concerned about internet access and how do we provide that? Susan?
Well, this is just like electricity. Bruce is exactly right. We're not saying that it should be free, but it should be reasonably priced. The problem is we've got high-speed internet access treated like a luxury for many Americans, a very high-priced sort of gold-plated service.
Wouldn't you argue that high-speed internet access is a luxury in this country as compared to other countries?
I think that's because of policy, not because of its own nature. It should be a utility in this country. It should be available at a reasonable price to everyone, just like electricity.
What is a reasonable price?
Oh, what you might pay for your phone bill, $20, $30 a month. That would be reasonable.
For high speed meaning yeah. What speed?
Well, Bruce and I are talking about real unlimited speeds potentially. What Salisbury's seeing can be provided at a very low price per household once it's available to the entire city.
And the issue that we're seeing in Charlotte, even as we have the conversation with service providers like cable providers, service providers want to roll out tiered services. Certain sectors of the population who are not using a whole lot of data can enroll here for a low cost. Others of us who have sort of a higher income, higher data needs can enroll here. That's recreating a digital divide that's going to haunt us in the future as more and more corporations, more and more service providers like healthcare, like the financial sector require that high-speed connection. Those who are relegated to lower speed, lower data caps are ultimately going to find themselves left behind once again. So let's build the infrastructure correctly. Let's provide a universal speed for everyone.
But isn't that key? It costs a lot of money to lay fiber optic cable, which is going to carry the broadband signal, doesn't it? I mean, these companies have to have a major investment in this. Google's giving them a little kick in the pants in Charlotte by jump-starting it. They're coming in here to put in digital fiber at super high speeds. And people say that one of the reasons that Google is involved in that here and where and elsewhere where they're involved in doing this is to kick the cable companies and the phone companies into providing the same access and the same speeds at a lower cost. That their intent is not really to take over the world with Google Fiber. It's to make others take over the world. Is that happening where Google Fiber is located?
Well, and it's also to – let's not be mistaken. It's also to sell a series of essential services. So within the Google universe –
and to get more information from us.
Right. It's not just about the fiber, but But it's a long-term strategy about what residents will do, what other services, whether it be Google TV, will be available. So Time Warner, for example, is not just interested in connecting people, but they're interested in Time Warner consumers.
And they have kicked up their speeds.
Correct.
Already. Yeah.
Particularly in Charlotte. I mean, just from my experience, you know, since the Google announcement and since coming into my role, all of the providers are now eagerly joining us at the table. If nothing else, because they don't want to be left out of the conversation.
But Susan, how does this happen? Because these companies really are in the business to make money. They have to be. It costs money to lay this fiber. It costs money to maintain the networks, et cetera. So how do you convince them that it's in their best interest? Maybe it's not in their best interest. I don't know. To provide this to everyone who needs it at a low, affordable price.
It's never going to be in the interest of anyone private provider in a particular city to do that. It's important to have competition, and Eric's exactly right that the entry of Google Fiber has caused Time Warner Cable to suddenly say we can offer higher speeds.
Imagine that.
A good thing. but the problem with this entire approach is that in the end, Google is not promising necessarily to reach every public housing unit.
Right.
And there may still be big digital inclusion pockets that are problems. Only a government has the obligation to serve everybody and to make sure that those prices are reasonable.
Although Google is offering they're offering several plans where they're putting in the fiber to handle people who can't afford to pay for the high-speed access. Will that be copied by the AT&Ts and the Time Warner Cables of the world and the Comcasts of the world?
We have initially found some good faith sort of conversations about what happens where the fiber ends. Google has reached out to say, and again, this requires connecting to the housing authority here in Charlotte. Yes, where fiber ends, we can provide a sort of a Wi-Fi connectivity to low-income housing sort of neighborhoods. And we are hopeful and optimistic that other service providers are following suit.
Well, Bruce, your job as the digital inclusion project manager is to find a strategy for universal broadband across the city of Charlotte and to move that access even into the lowest income neighborhoods, right?
That is correct.
Now, you've only been in this job. This job's only existed since the beginning of the year. Where are you in that process?
Technically, it's only existed since August 15th.
Okay.
But,
So where are you? What have you been doing?
You know, right now, just doing a lot, engaging with community partners, the steering team, the stakeholder group, which is, 90-plus community organizations here in Charlotte who have expressed an interest in being involved in this process. And, early on, it's sitting in the cockpit of an airplane that's not quite all the way built, but you're on the runway and you need to take off. So there's an element of, working across the community to connect the interests of groups who are already doing this work to amplify and allow them an easier pathway to accomplish what they're looking to do.
I hate to air our dirty laundry and our little insecurities in front of a guest from out of town, Susan Crawford from Harvard, but we have this need in Charlotte to be world class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does that need feed? Will it feed an impetus to push this thing to happen?
I think it will. Sorry. Especially here in Charlotte, we have a sort of opportunity task force that constantly talks about, in terms of socioeconomic mobility, Charlotte is almost dead last. So one of their key interests is how can we leverage digital inclusion and access to really talk about socioeconomic mobility.
I was going to bring that up next, so we'll get to that when we come into the conversation on the other side of the break. We're here with Dr. Eric Friedman, Dean of the James L. Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte, Bruce Clark, our first digital inclusion project manager, and Susan Crawford from Harvard University Law School, author of The Responsive City, Engaging Communities Through the Data Smart Governance. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings LLP, a full-service law firm whose lawyers are industry professionals experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation. Details at babc.com. And Taylor Richards & Conger, locally owned and operated specialty shop for men featuring European and American tailored clothing and accessories. Artisan crafted jackets with working sleeve buttons and high thread count shirtings. Details at trcstyle.com. Last week, state regulators in Nevada ruled that daily fantasy sports games need to be licensed. So on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, they examine how the multi-billion dollar industry operates and why the Justice Department and the FBI have opened investigations. That's coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show. You can join our conversation on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, and we're coming right back.
This is Jeff Bundy from WFAE's membership team. As WFAE continues to work towards the overall goal of its fall membership campaign, we hope that you will consider making a contribution at WFAE.org or by phone at 704-549-9000. Contributions of any amount go a very long way at WFAE and can be recognized with a one-year subscription to Wine Spectator magazine as our way of saying thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We asked a question on social media a little while ago. Do you think Charlotte is on the path to successful digital inclusion for its citizens, and what efforts would you recommend? I'll share some of the responses with you in just a couple of seconds. Bruce, you certainly have your work cut out for you as Charlotte's first digital inclusion project manager, because the Knight School, the research from the Knight School shows that more than 40% of residents in certain Charlotte communities do not use the internet anywhere. They don't even go to the library to use the internet. A drop-off rate more than twice the national average. How do you explain that? Or do you explain it? Can it be explained?
I think
is it that people don't see a need for it?
Well, yes. There are, I think, two reasons. One, as Susan pointed out, when we talk about cost, it's easy for us to say what something like that should cost. It's another thing to reach into a neighborhood and say, what can you afford? And some of these households are making very significant decisions. If we talk about a single-parent household with multiple children, multiple economic pressures, the difference between $20 a month and $9 a month, if we can bring the price down, but if we can also talk about relevance. So part of this is meeting residents where they are. What are you trying to accomplish in your everyday life, and how will access get you there? So it's about price, but it's also about helping them understand how to prioritize, and the notion of relevance is really significant here.
Susan, how are they doing this elsewhere?
Well, Bruce is exactly on the same path that, for example, the city of Los Angeles is struggling with this question. It turns out you really need a lot of helping hands to assist people in understanding relevance for healthcare, for applying for a job, for getting a better education for their kids. So they're not seeing it as an entertainment medium, but as a ladder to a more productive, thriving life. But that takes getting over some barriers of fear, lack of knowledge, and just people are just trying to survive. Mm. So it takes a lot. It takes a lot of neighborhood organizations and a lot of helping hands.
I want to come back and talk about upward mobility in a second, but what's in it for business? Do businesses, it would seem to me, would want more people connected?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a really clear R&D research and development component to broadband and high-speed access to, you know, the future economy and what kind of tools they're developing, but also in the way that our workforce is evolving. I mean, we think about people working remotely, working from being able to work from anywhere. If you come to Charlotte, if you're thinking about locating your business here or growing your business here, you know, your employees being able to connect to their work wherever they are is a significant component of that. Mm. But that also is, you know, relevant to their workforce development. If we're not training people in our community and giving them access to these tools so that they become better equipped for the jobs of the future, then these companies are either going to have to move locations to where those people are, or they're going to have to spend significant amount of money recruiting them to come here. And that's what's happening now. I mean, we see companies in Charlotte having to open offices in other cities just to recruit talent. And so think about all the money that's being spent outside of our community that could come back and could be spent right here in Charlotte.
Are there other cities in North Carolina working to do what Charlotte is working to do, and are they, how successful have they been?
From my experience, I think that we're leading the case in the Carolinas, in North Carolina specifically. I think that there's an effort in the Triangle right now. They've reached out to us to build bridges and see how we can work together and think about this in a regional approach. Mm. We've also had some really wonderful conversations with the folks in South Carolina who have been doing this work now in a slightly different way, but for a number of years. In that same context. So there are players in our region who are actively participating in this conversation.
And more closely, I think in Davidson, Pat Millen and his group, E2D, are taking a very sort of focused approach in terms of closing the loop with the school system. So what does it mean for a child to have a laptop and a bring-your-own-device school? And do they have access? Are they wired in the home? So they've been really dealing with this micro-community, dealing with school-age children to bridge the gap for them.
Upward mobility in Charlotte is less than in other American cities. It's kind of an indictment. It's more difficult to move from one socioeconomic level to another in Charlotte. Is that part of what is fueling the drop-off in internet access, or is the lack of that access what is partially fueling that the non-existence of upward mobility?
Yeah, I'd say the lack of access. I mean, I tell people in my age bracket that this is the preeminent challenge of our generation, that if we don't find a way to solve this digital divide, that, you know, when it's time for me to, you know, in 30, 40, 50 years, when I'm thinking about or hopefully retiring, that the challenges that our world is going to face, and even more locally, just our community, they're going to be likely be unbearable. I mean, we will see things that we don't want to see unless we attack this challenge. And I think it's easy for people to, I shouldn't say I think, I've seen from conversations that people get it. They understand in their own lives. If you tell somebody, you know, give me your cell phone and your computer and live your life for a week, they, you know, most people almost pass out.
I've turned around on the way to work because I left my phone on the dresser. I can't go anywhere. I turn around and come back and get it. We love to say we're number one in America. We love it. But we're not. Susan, you believe that the U.S. should be leading the world in ensuring that its citizens have access to ubiquitous, these are your words, ubiquitous, world-class, competitive, and inexpensive fiber optic connectivity. Instead, other nations in Asia, in Europe, are way ahead of us. Why and how do we catch up? And is it simply a matter of adopting their model?
You know, I have to say, I have never experienced being embarrassed to be an American until my most recent trip to South Korea, where people in Seoul really feel that coming to America is like coming to a third world country when it comes to communications. It's sort of peaceful and relaxing in America. and that is hard for us to imagine because as a people, we don't tend to travel much. We think that we're number one.
Right.
In Norway, you know, they just assume that communications are ubiquitous, vanishingly inexpensive, unlimited capacity. It's just like having electricity. It is everywhere you go. There is no friction, no waiting for some spinning circle on a screen, no wasting time, no wandering around looking for an open Wi-Fi hotspot. So we should be looking the rest of the world in the rearview mirror. We are, after all, the country that invented the internet. And the first generation of great internet applications came from the U.S. But the new things are not going to come from here. We're not going to develop a giant middle class to serve our market unless we dramatically change our approach to infrastructure policy.
Tell me why. Tell me how we can do it. Why we are where we are and how we can do it. Is it because we are a capitalist, market-driven economy, and they are not? I mean, if you're talking about Sweden, it's more socialist than we are. I don't know what South Korea is like, but why?
This is just a question of policy. This is because of things that happened in Washington starting in 2003, 2004. We deregulated all of high-speed internet access and made it a luxury product, essentially, just like, you know, a top-end restaurant. And what's happened is that only recently, in the last 12 months, the Federal Communications Commission has moved back towards classifying high-speed internet access as a utility and has begun looking at these state laws that are blocking cities from making the choice to install fiber for themselves, as Wilson and Salisbury did, and is starting to treat this as basic infrastructure, but just like roads and airports.
But won't they be fought by the tremendous economic power of communications companies around the country that control access to the pipe?
Well, here comes the analogy. The exact same thing happened with electricity. That was subject to a series of very tightly held cartels in America until FDR took it on and said, no, every American needs to have inexpensive electricity, and not only funded the rural electric cooperatives but also regulated the electricity industry. So we can do a lot.
So you worked with the FCC transition team between the Bush and the Obama administrations. Mm-hmm. How would you describe those two administrations' approaches to this problem?
Well, I think that people have been evolving on this issue as they come to recognize its salience. And really not until recently in the Obama administration was this taken on with the energy and vigor that it should be.
And he's taken it on now because he is no longer electable and he's an outgoing president and he wants to put his stamp on this. Is that the reason or is there some other reason why?
Well, he's picking the big issues, climate change, relationship with Cuba, and now telecommunications is right up there on the radar screen with immigration and everything else. So it's become a basic policy issue where it wasn't a few years ago.
Given Congress's inability to decide what color the sky is from day to day, is this going to be, Bruce and Eric, is this going to be if we're going to solve this problem, is it going to be a grassroots, local level up proposition using organizations like the one you're in charge of?
I think it's going to be multi-pronged. I think there needs to be a strong grassroots efforts in the community because, as we know, the strong grassroots efforts have the ability to affect politics. But it's also going to be driven by our enterprise and large companies who understand that they're losing market share the more and more, the higher the internet speeds go, the fewer people who are able to access it, the less customers who can quickly buy their things.
But if you're in the lower socioeconomic levels of society to the point where you cannot afford internet access, even dial-up, you can't afford dial-up, you can't afford to buy the device that connects to the internet, whether it's a Chromebook or a whatever, what's in it for business to get those people? They don't have any money to spend.
I mean, you could just take healthcare, for example. I mean, think about the cost of an uninsured person walking into an emergency room to the hospital versus that person being able to have a device and access in their home where they might be able to access information provided by the hospital or the healthcare provider and potentially prevent a visit that was unnecessary in the first place. Mm. And, to scale, that's billions of dollars across our country.
So this is a serious economic issue going forward for domestic industry in the country, and it's a serious issue for worldwide competitiveness, for not just Charlotte, but for the United States to be competitive in a worldwide economy. Why haven't we taken this seriously?
I would defer to the other two for more an expert opinion, but I would say that it's also a matter of just the reality of time. I mean, technology is evolving so fast, and the new fiber and the ability to deploy that across an urban environment in a fairly rapid fashion is a newer phenomenon. I mean, fiber hasn't been around for hundreds of years, so as technology evolves, we have to be able to evolve with it, and that's a little bit of a cop-out for some, but I think it's a reality.
And I think we're also locked into some long-standing understandings of technology, as Susan pointed out. We can look backward. So even in the more recent era of sort of cable, where public educational government access in the 80s and 90s used to be something that was negotiated into franchise agreements, it only happened in those cities where residents were engaged with the process and were advocating and talking to their municipal leaders and demanding that the cable operators come to the table and provide a service so that TV was not simply a one-way path of communication. We simply lay new technologies into those existing frameworks.
So we asked on social media, do you think Charlotte's on the path to successful digital inclusion? And Brandon on Facebook writes, absolutely. It is not even a question. In order to continue to thrive, the city needs to position itself as an incubator of innovation in technology and provide opportunities for startups to interact with big businesses, creating a win-win environment for long-term economic growth and stability. I'm not sure that answered the question, but it's certainly an opinion. It's a good opinion. David, why is all data not open in Charlotte, specifically bus location data? We could have apps to tell us when the next bus is coming, but CATS won't release the data that they have, and we as taxpayers have paid for it. Now, I have an app, or I had an app on my phone. I can't find my phone right now, but I had an app on my phone that did that. You could look it up and you could find out when the bus was coming. Is that not available anymore?
You know, it's funny. I was just having this conversation yesterday with someone here in Charlotte who's interested in the same topic, and they had the same opinion as David, the contributor there. So it sounds like there's an energy in the community to make that happen, but it does not exist directly from cats yet.
On our website, Don writes, in your book, Susan, you stated, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. This poses a question as to how cities will measure its entire population of people suffering from the digital divide if they are data invisible. How can we make people not seen a part of the analytics?
That's a deep and important question. And that's, for me, getting fiber in place, Wi-Fi access everywhere that's public and free is essential for a city to be truly responsive to its rent, to its residents, all of its residents, so that we don't amplify and entrench existing inequalities.
And here in Charlotte, we have a number of community partners who have access to many of the disconnected communities in a very in real life way. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the key areas for our engagement is not just engaging people who are already connected, obviously, but having that real human experience to be able to collect that data and understand where they're at.
We only have about a minute left. This may be an unfair question, Susan, but you served as a member of the New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Advisory Council on Technology and Innovation. You're now a member of New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's Broadband Task Force. Is this the kind of thing these two mayors are working, have worked toward and are working toward universal access as a public utility, essentially?
Absolutely. Especially de Blasio's very focused on public housing as a center, a locus for needed upgrades in high-speed internet access.
And how, if we ever reach this stage where we do have a lot of data coming into citizens and who are then becoming more participatory, how do they find the time to do this and not become just deluged by the reams of data we can't even imagine? How?
Well, let's simplify this a bit. You can think of it as customer service. A local city government should be able to serve its people easily so they understand what's going on, where the money is going, what their elected representatives are up to. Not everybody needs to be engaging constantly, but they should feel that local government is useful in serving them.
Susan Crawford is a professor at Harvard Law School and co-author of The Responsive City, Engaging Communities Through Data Smart Governance. She joined us from Harvard, and Bruce Clark has been with us in our studio. He's the first ever Charlotte Digital Inclusion Project Manager from the Knight School. His boss, Dr. Eric Friedman, the dean of the James L. Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte. All three with us, and I thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.